listener production.
Hi, this is Paul McIntyre. Welcome to the MI3 Audio Edition. I've been a business journalist for 25 years covering the marketing, media, agency and tech sectors. In this series, we talk to industry leaders about the global and local developments that you need to be across this week. Well, buckle up for a tour de force with my guest today. John Evans is the name, the voice and the de-identified face of one of the top marketing podcasters globally, who also happens to be the CMO at System One, the UK firm which benchmarks creative content, that is ads, across various media channels. Before his current B2B marketing gig, John was a marketer at the likes of BrewDog and LucasAid and a bunch of others. Now, his firm says it makes the rational case for emotion. You might recall last year, Tourism Australia CMO Susan Coggle and the work her team did launching the Say G'day global campaign rated as one of the best in the world, according to System One's benchmarking. We'll cover a lot of turf today, from Coca-Cola's public announcement a few weeks back that it was moving 60% of its total advertising budget to digital channels, up from its current 40%, and why, to Amazon being one of the most creative and effective advertisers in the world right now in System One's database. I've got to say, I didn't see that one coming. We'll also probe John on who are the standout global marketers today based on his conversations with some of the world's biggest and perhaps best from his podcast series. And perhaps most interestingly for the Australian market, what the hell is a CMO from a creative benchmarking outfit doing in Australia this week, keynoting a conference on the future of TV advertising? And of course, BVOD and the new ad-supported streamers racing to market. MI3, I should say, is the media partner for the event tomorrow, which has sold out. So you'll have to follow MI3's series coverage over the next week or more. Gratuitous plug over, John Evans. So great to have you on MI3's Audio Edition, and I should stop talking. So John, let's start with this idea of making the rational case for emotion. Do brands and marketers actually care about this? And actually, how does it help their business case?
Yeah, good question. It's actually more important than I think people realize. In fact, at System One, we wrote a book about emotion and why it matters. And I kind of love the conclusion of the book, actually, because it said that as human beings, we think less than we think we think. The more we feel, the more likely we are to buy. And, you know, it's a clever way of saying it, but actually it's very true that as people, we don't make decisions in the logical, rational manner that we think we do. So if you ask someone a question, what do you think about this product or what do you think about this ad? The answer you get probably won't be that predictive of what they'll go on and do. But if you ask them about, how do you feel? How does it make you feel? How strong is that emotion? What do you associate with the brand? If you ask a different question, you actually get a much more useful answer that is much more likely to predict. I think it was Rory Sutherland that said, you know, system one is like the Oval Office and system two is the press office. It's like, you know, the power in our decision making is our system one, as we call it, but it's our system two rational part of our brain that sort of after the event goes, this is why I did what I did sort of thing. So what we do at System One is we just try and understand why people make the decisions that they make, and we use emotion to get to that answer.
So this is kind of all around behavioral economics, right? And Daniel Kahneman, who's, for those that don't know, is the Nobel Prize winner in economics, but he talked about exactly what you're talking about now, right? This is where it all comes from?
100%. So Daniel Kahneman, Nobel Prize winner, number one best-selling author, behavioral scientist. Yes, he wrote a book called Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow, and it really uncovers this concept of system one and system two, system one being your intuition and instinct that tends to make the decisions, and then your system two, which is the rational, more logical part, tends to sort of post-rationalize it. So we took that to heart, really, and what we decided is to test that hypothesis out by looking at hundreds and thousands of ads. And what we did is we looked at a 15-year time period. We looked at ads going back a long, long time. And what we did is we looked at the impact the media had and the impact that creative had. And what we did is we neutralized it for media, because obviously brands spend different amounts of money. So we took the ESOV, or the share of voice, and we basically took that effect out. And what we said is, what effect did the creative itself have? And more than that, that the emotion that it creates. And what we did is we kind of reversed back to look at those campaigns that increased the market share for the brand and those that didn't. And we looked at what was unique about those that did. And we uncovered this very simple truth that Daniel Kahneman identifies is that the more happy you feel about the brand, the more positive emotion you feel about the brand, and the stronger that emotion, the more likely you are to go and buy. So we found that happiness and surprise and positive emotion contributed a lot to the performance of those brands, to the extent that we're able to do a correlation over all that data set. And we uncovered this insight. We've then since tested it in over 250 different categories around the world. And what we've done is we've looked at campaigns. And what we find is, and again, this backs other data sources. I know Nielsen have got a similar data source here, that roughly half the effect comes from the media, half the effect comes from the creative. And but in every single example, in all the 250, that if you overlay emotional response, it increases the predictability of the campaign. So basically, emotion matters and the creative matters. So when we talk about the medium and the message, we mustn't forget the message. It's as important as the media.
There tends to be much more conversation, though, doesn't there, about the channel choice as opposed to the creative and the messaging. And it's whether you even hear on earnings calls from listed companies, they're talking about, we're going to go into digital, or we're going to go into this channel, or we're out of that. But there's no talk, very little talk, around sort of what you're talking about, the emotion and the creativity of contribution to effectiveness. Most marketers, I assume, buy what you're talking about here in Kahneman and, in the emotion. But how do they go, John, convincing finance teams, CEO and executive leadership teams that this is actually real McCoy stuff? It's not rubbery, fluffy creatives talking to themselves.
Well, what you said there is the exam question that System One is here to answer. And actually, it's interesting that I often get in conversations with creative agencies or brand marketers, and they kind of assume that our job is to mark their homework and sort of tell them whether the creative was any good or not. Now, we do that, but the actual reason that we exist is to provide that rational case for emotion to the decision makers in an organization. So if you've got this amazing idea that's very emotional and you're trying to sell it into a rational business, most businesses are rational, right? Most people that sit on exec level positions have come up through sales. They might have come up through finance. They've done MBAs. They're very bright. They'll be challenged on business results and heavily incentivized to shift those business results. So unless you can present the power of the creative idea in the context of the business performance, you're going to really struggle. And if you don't do that, what happens is everyone's got an opinion. Everyone's going to go, I like this, I don't like that, and I don't think it's funny. We don't talk about the brand enough. That's what happens. So what we're trying to do at System One is we're trying to put a value on the creative. And we've tried to find a simple way of doing it. It's a simple 5-star scale. 1-star being, this is likely, it's not perfect, but it's likely not to have any impact in the long term, up to 5-star where it's got an exceptional impact. And the power of that is incredible, because as a CMO, as a senior marketer, your job is to buy the work from the creative agency, but you have to sell it in. And so what happens is, so what we provide is the data to support the decision to, in terms of which creative is best, how to make the creative better, but ultimately how to get the board and or the decision makers to sign off the media spend. And this is where it connects actually to media, because the more you can demonstrate that the creative is going to work, the more confidence you then have in your media buy. Because at the end of the day, the media buy is probably one of the single biggest investments you're going to make as a business. And why would you do that unless you know the creative is actually going to create the change that you want? So you have to do the two things together. I think if you separate them and just talk about, opportunities to see or reach or frequency and those kind of things, and you don't actually ask yourself, is the message going to land and going to work? Will I be remembered? Will I create an emotional response? Will people create the right associations with the brand that I want them to? Unless you're asking those questions, then you potentially could be wasting a lot of money.
Any examples of how that works in the real world with executive leadership and CEOs and CFOs, John, have you got an anecdote there?
Well, I've got a very dramatic example, actually. So between 2016 and 2018, I was the marketing director for LucasAid. LucasAid's the number one energy drink in the UK. Very successful, very popular brand. History goes back 85, 90 years. And the UK government introduced a soft drink sugar tax. And I had to, LucasAid had one of the highest levels of sugar in the industry. And I had to reformulate it down quite substantially. And what happened is we had a massive consumer backlash. I mean, we had literally millions of people on social media talking about it. We had, our consumer care line was overwhelmed. We had a very big reaction to the extent that we lost around 20% of our business in about 3 months. It was one of the most dramatic moments in my career. Now, as the marketing director,
because it wasn't sweet enough. Was that what it was about? It just wasn't sweet enough.
It's a very interesting insight, actually, because it was actually more about the fact that we had changed it. And in fact, I then did some research back into the classic Coke in the 80s when they did the same thing. What was interesting is it wasn't that people had tried it and didn't like it, because actually we'd done the testing and we'd made sure that at a sensory level, it was a match. People didn't like the fact that we'd changed it, that we had mucked about with their favorite drink. And so what happened is that we did some research actually to find out why have you stopped drinking Lucozade? And most people had stopped drinking because they'd heard about the change. Not that they'd tried it. They hadn't tried it and decided. They'd just heard that it tasted differently. And it was going back to the Daniel Kahneman idea, I then looked at the research around the classic Coke launch. And the conclusion was it was called the wrong question problem. And basically the question that Coke had asked at the time was, do you like our new formulation? And the answer was yes. The question they should have asked is, how do you feel about the fact that we're changing your favorite drink? And that was right. Going back to system one, system two, that was the question I should have asked is not, do you like the new formulation in isolation? Because the answer was actually just as many people did. How would you feel if we changed the formulation of Lucozade? And that question would have made a big difference. So there I was, with a major drama in the business, multi-millions of pounds at stake. And I was given the task of relaunching the brand, going back to the core. So what we did is we went back to what is it about Lucozade that people love about it? And it's energy, right? So it's very simple. So our idea we came up with with our partners at Grey Advertising was energy beats everything. But in life, it's energy that usually conquers all. You can be as talented as you want, but unless you've got the energy to win the battle or, stay up late to complete the task or, run a marathon, whatever, energy is the thing that will get you through. So we went back to the core idea of the brand. We came up with a big new campaign. We did lots of in-store activation. We did lots of sampling to remind people that it doesn't, it still tastes good. But the key question was, before the media spend was signed off, the CEO said to me, I want you to prove to me that this is going to deliver the business result that we need it to recover the brand and get the brand back into growth, right? That was the exam question. And I thought, how am I going to do that? Because we know as marketers, right, that it's an art and a science. It's not a pure science. I can't guarantee the result. Lots of things can happen. Prices can change. The weather can be good. The weather can be bad. There's lots of things that affect how things sell. But at the time, I just met a company called System One. And what they were able to do is by measuring emotion, they were obviously able to predict the impact it might have on the market share of the brand. So I got the founder of the company, John Kieran, in to speak to the exec. And basically what he did is he broke down the science, the Daniel Kahneman thinking, the validation work the team had done. And they were fascinated. And what I realize is, most people don't think about marketing or advertising very much, particularly in a C-suite where you've got HR, you've got finance, you've got ops, you've got, do you know what I mean? The people around the table, they're not marketers. They don't instinctively necessarily get what we do. They were fascinated by the science, but most of all, they were reassured by the rigor and the data that we're able to put a value on creativity and a value on the emotion. And what that meant is that, I mean, the real proof point actually was not in that meeting, as good as that meeting was. A few weeks later, we had a cost-cutting meeting where we were reviewing budgets. And I remember the CFO, bless him, he said, we're going to go around the room and we're going to look at everyone else's budgets before we look at John's, because we've already done the evaluation of the creative and we already know what it's going to deliver. So it puts
that doesn't
CMO,
happen a lot for marketers though, does it?
It doesn't. I know. The thing is, like, the marketer is always the one without the data, always the first one to get the budget cut, always the one that's kind of everyone's arguing, have got a debate about is the campaign good or not. It's a very tough position, and it's why CMOs often don't last in the role. But what we're trying to do is bring the data, to the table to give them the confidence to create what they know is going to have an impact in the marketplace.
So did it work, John? And what was the, is there a link to sales on this at all with your experience with Lucozade?
You're right. This is a real lesson in long and short, because when we launched the campaign, everyone expected day one, somehow the sales to turn around and suddenly recover overnight. And a lot of people were saying to me, man, you should be a bit worried by now, shouldn't you? And I said, don't judge me in 12 weeks, judge me in 12 months. Because what I was trying to balance, and any good student in marketing will know this, is you have to balance the long and the short. So we were doing the right thing in store. We were building distribution, we were building displays, we were doing sampling. We had a lovely promotion we were doing at the time with Lara Croft. There was a new film out, and we'd done this brilliant collaboration that was getting great traction on social media. So we were doing the in-market stuff, you know, people that were buying us, you know, we were capturing as much of the market as we could. But the key thing was we had to re-establish the brand in the long term. Now, 12 months after the shock that we had when the sales went down, we were back into growth by 8%. So within 12 months, we'd managed that really big shift from being down considerably to being back up to where we were before. But it took a huge effort.
If you say 12 months, John, there must have been some nervous Nellies and wobbly knees at some point, including yourself. If it took, how long did it take to see impact? Because if you have promised something and you're waiting, what, 6-8 months to see some impact in the business, that's a hard slog.
It is. And this is the thing is, you know, probably to put a big campaign together is 6 months, right? Even if you're going fast. So if you're going through the briefing process, the consumer insight, planning, you've got the creative development, you've got the production, you've got to buy the media and so on. So it took us at least 6 months. So we had, I broke it down into sections. So we had the immediate response, which was get in store, you know, build displays, make sure that we're capturing as much of the demand that does exist out there as we possibly can. So that's the sticking plaster. Then we did in the next 3 months, we then did this promotion, as I said, with Lara Croft, which was a little bit more about re-engaging. And that was when we launched the idea of Energy Beats Everything. So we did a partnership. So we found a quick turnaround media to engage with. But it took us 6 months really from start to finish to get the big campaign out there. That's TV, it's out of home, it was radio and so on. So that did take us 6 months. And of course, you know, even on day one, that doesn't have a magic bullet, you know, impact, because it turns out that in soft drinks, most people buy your brand 2 or 3 times a year. So if you think about that, if the average person is only buying 2 or 3 times a year, then you have to be on air for 6 months to capture everybody that might be considering buying you. So actually it played out the Ehrenberg Bass idea of light buyers incredibly, because it really was about 12 months until we saw that growth coming back and we were able to see, you know, get back into growth from the decline. So it's a real lesson in patient, well, doing the right thing, testing and having confidence in using data to value creativity, but also in patience as well, in realizing that these things do take time.
How did the CEO and CFO finance teams cope with that though? Waiting.
It was very difficult.
Were you at some point going, you've taken us up a garden path here, John? Any chance?
It was a lot of difficult conversations. And actually, look, there's a tough end to this story, because I do get fired at the end of this story, by the way. And the decision was probably made.
Story.
I know. The decision was probably made before the result. So in fact, it was, I remember Stephen, who ran LucasAid for me, he was the head of marketing. After I got fired, he sent me a text going, good news, mate. I've just had the Nielsen figures in and we're in, I think it was either 8 or 12% growth. So he said, at least you leave knowing that you had achieved it. And the difficult thing with these things is that the decisions often get taken way earlier, you know. And so I think what happened, if I'm honest, is they kept me on long enough to get the campaign delivered and do all the hard work to make it happen. And then, of course, you know, the CEO and my successor could then take the credit afterwards.
It's a really good point, though, in terms of sort of CMOs, marketing teams trying to get the tolerance or the elasticity from the company, the organization, to be patient. It's a hard thing. It's just maybe sometimes why they don't do it, because it's actually easier to find something else and not put your neck out.
Yeah. And look, we've had pandemic, we've had recession. A lot of companies are having cost cuts even now. It's a very, very familiar conversation. CMOs are having this conversation all around the world all the time, is how do you get the brands to invest longer term beyond the next quarter that's coming up? And this is a real tension. And this is why the data matters, right? This is why we have to bring the evidence for long and the short of it. It's why we have to bring System One testing to show that it will have an impact over 12 months. And at the end of the day, most shareholders are actually in it for the long term. So if you can, you know, bring that argument to the board, you often get a sympathetic hearing.
Backtracking a little bit, John, on what you said earlier in convincing CFOs and executive leadership team about the fact that this was going to work, was it the score from System One or was it the science of Kahneman that sort of moved the rational people in the organization?
The answer to that is actually both. So what we chose to do in the situation we were facing is I actually got System One to come in and present to the exec team as a whole. So it was in the case of Lucozade, it was the biggest investment we'd made in the brand ever. And therefore, there were a lot of people looking at it. Everyone's KPIs were aligned around the success of the campaign. So the two things that had to happen, firstly, I had to explain to people why emotion matters, what the behavioral science evidence for that was in terms of Daniel Kahneman. So we explained that. I got the founder of the company to come in and explain why that works. And people found that fascinating. I mean, we forget that, you know, we talk about advertising a lot. Most people don't. And most people don't really stop and think about how it works. Most people assume it doesn't work, actually. So, you know, you've got to really kind of explain to people that, you know, the science behind advertising and the role it plays in building a brand. So that was essential. And then what I had to do was explain why the System One score would predict the outcome. Now, nothing's perfect. Now, again, when we talk about predictions, it's a measure of how likely it is to work in real life, all things being equal. So obviously media spend, competitor activity, category performance. There's a lot of things that, you know, will happen and dictate how a campaign goes. But what System One do is isolate what the role of the creative might be in that mix. And, you know, we have a very simple 5-star scale where 1 star is it's likely to have no impact at all on the brand, up to 5-star, which is an exceptional level of impact of around 3% share of the market. And, you know, we've studied tens of thousands of campaigns to kind of see the difference between a 1 and a 5-star. So in this case, what I was able to do very simply is say, in our category of soft drinks, the average is 3-star. And therefore, you know, we're not going to launch a campaign unless we know it's statistically significantly better than the average in the category. So it enabled me to benchmark the performance of the company historically, the performance of the category historically, and say, well, if we're going to shift the needle on this brand, and the science would suggest, or the data would suggest that, you know, brands grow when they have an excess share of voice. Brands also grow more than that when they have an excess creative performance compared to the category overall. And so what I was trying to do is say, we can outspend the competition and we can afford to, but we've got to out-creative the competition as well in terms of creative performance. The two things together are like a multiplier. So so you're right. It was both the science and simple education of why it matters, combined with a data point that was anchored in like benchmarking the category and where we the level we had to reach in order to make a difference.
It is true, though, despite the economic or behavioral economics and the science behind that, you still get resistance about creative and creativity being fluffy and ineffective, right? So, you know, in my conversation sometimes with the rational end of town, the moment I talk about Kahneman winning the Nobel Prize for behavioral economics is about emotion over rational, it sort of stops people because it's hard to argue with that stuff, right? But there still is a pervasive sense in a lot of organizations, certainly in Australia anyway, that the creative conversation is a little bit fuzzy and whiffy, waffy, you know, who cares? That's changing in say, in the UK at least, is it? Or how do you feel about it?
Well, firstly, just to declare I'm biased because I work for a company that does it. So again, to everyone listening, you know, declare my bias up front. However, that said, you know, what we've tried to do, and again, the reason we say the rational case for emotion is what we've tried to do is take the behavioral science that Kahneman has uncovered and prove it again and again and again. Now, again, sometimes when we have people criticize us, they're criticizing us without studying the data we've got, without reading the books we've written, without looking at the case studies we've done. But we've now tested over 100,000 ads around the world. And what we've also done is we now do case studies looking at each category, each major customer we work with. What we do is we look at what the prediction said, and then we look at what actually happened a year later. So what we've done, to give you the simple answer to it, is we've now looked at over 260 different case studies around the world of customers that we've worked with. And what we've done in every single case is said, to what extent did the media spend predict the change in market share? And to what extent did the creative also impact on the market share change in the following 12 months? Now, here's the headline. And this is the point where I get very confident, is in every single case, the creative improved the predictability of the campaign results. If you look at the correlation between how much they spent and their market share, you have a loose correlation. It's positive, but it's loose. In other words, how much you spend makes some impact to some degree. The moment you put in the star rating, which is our measure of emotion, it becomes a much stronger, it doubles the strength of that correlation. So in very simple, if I were to oversimplify it for everyone listening, right? Basically, half the impact is coming from media and half the impact is coming from the creative. But if you don't measure the creative as we define it by its ability to create emotion in the long term, then you're literally missing half of the result. Now, one small caveat to that is we've done that over 260 times. The result is the same every time. Now, the result varies in terms of its strength, right? So in every single case study we've ever done, measuring emotion improves the likely prediction of the outcome. The degree to which that happens is quite big. There's quite a big difference. So in some categories, that's a lot. And in some categories, it's a little. But in every category, you know, emotion matters, you know, to some extent. So, I mean, of course, the problem with simplifying anything in life is that people then go, oh, well, there's an exception. Well, of course there is, because, you know, what we're representing is the average, right? On average, it's like this. But because we measure advertising in every single category, we can see how different categories vary. So there are some categories where it's very emotional, like pet care, for example, or confectionery, right? There are some categories where it's a lot less emotional, like, you know, financial services. So, you know, again, because we measured everything, when we work with customers, we actually work with them within the category context they operate, and we measure the impact that emotion has within the category. We look at it, the impact in both the next 12 weeks and the next 12 months. So we have two measures, you know, the short and the long.
I just want to just be really clear here, though. So those 1,000...
Over 100,000 ads in
100,000 ads, yeah. In those case studies, they were all linked back somehow to business impact. There was a link to revenue or sales or something, right? Or is it just about cut through to the consumer?
Really, really good point. So in our pre-testing, what we're doing is we're looking at the likely impact. So we're basically measuring how much emotion, how strong the brand is, what associations people feel, second by second as they're watching, how do they feel? So you basically get a diagnostics, right, in terms of how you might change the ads, right? But then the star rating is our prediction, and it is a prediction, that's really important to remember, it's a prediction of what we think might happen in the next 12 months. The spike rating is the short term of how likely it is to impact in the short term. And that's a slightly different measure. But again, we validated that. Then what we do, now that's the pretest, and then that's used to help guides and help people in the creative process improve what they're doing. But then what we do is with our larger customers is we then look over a long period of time with them. So for example, if I take our biggest customer, which is the biggest advertiser in the UK, they've spent the last 4 years looking at the correlation between our spike rating, short-term impact, and their performance in the next 6 weeks. They look at the campaign period and go, did we sell more or less than we normally do when we normally do that campaign, and look at the spike rating. They then look over 12 months and go, did we change our market share? Now, the reason we use market share, by the way, is categories go up and categories go down. So if you're in a category that's exploding, you might have a very bad campaign, but still grow because you happen to be in a category that's going up. Equally, a category that's shrinking, you might do a very good job, but still decline a bit because the category is going down. So that's the reason we use market share, because market share is basically, you know, it tells you the truth and it kind of accounts for, you know, everything else, all the noise that's going on around you. So that's why we pick on share.
What then makes a good ad, and is emotion relative to the individual?
Yes, you're right. Emotion is very important. I mean, we have five general bits of advice. And again, obviously it gets specific and categories do differ. So that obviously when you go into categories, you know, there are certain kind of, you know, rules that apply. But broadly speaking, the five would be, the first thing is emotion matters. So speak to the heart, don't bother the brain. That would be the first thing. So try and come up with an idea that makes people feel something. Now, there are loads. Now, in terms, it goes to the next thing, which is, well, how do you do that? And then the second point is we talk about a story, right? A story arc. So it's important that you tell a story. Now, it sounds very obvious, this, but most advertising is not storytelling. Most advertising is lots of scenes, lots of close-ups of the product, lots of messages. And what we find is that when you have lots, you know, when you try and overload a bit of communication, you actually neutralize its impact, because there's so much being thrown at you that you actually don't really take on any of it. And so Think about the story. Think about the simple telling of the story. Take people on a journey. It's the sort of advice you'd give an author or a filmmaker, you know, or someone doing a Netflix documentary. You know, it's like, you know, create the drama at the beginning, create the resolution at the end, make sure people feel happy. I mean, back to Kahneman, actually, there's a thing called a peak end rule, which is how you feel after, at the end of something, is predictive of how you feel overall. So it's important to, you know, kind of end on a high, as we might say. So that's very important. We talk about music as well. So the music is, you know, if there was one kind of hack I could give people, it's the power of soundtrack. So how you feel is actually determined a lot about what you hear. So, you know, if you have an uplifting soundtrack or a moody soundtrack or a dramatic soundtrack, it all changes how you feel. The amazing thing we found actually is that what you hear changes the interpretation of what you're seeing. So we can take the same ad, we can change the soundtrack, we can change it by about 2 stars on our 5-star scale. We can also change what people associate with the brand, the message they take out, how they feel about the brand, how much they remember as well. So it's incredibly powerful. So again, soundtrack will be the next thing. Characters will be something else, because as humans, we want to relate to the people in the ad. And we've done loads of studies on, you know, do you see yourself in advertising when you're talking about diverse audiences, for example? And, you know, we've seen an emotional uplift when people that maybe aren't represented in advertising see themselves. You know, if you're telling jokes, you know, you want to tell the right jokes. So, you know, the character is very important. And the final thing, which is essential, and this is very much kind of on Ehrenberg Bass territory as well, is what we call fluency. Now, fluency is basically the ease with which people can associate the advert to you. Now, there's a wonderful thing that my colleague Orlando invented, which is called the fluent device. And what he means by that is, in communication, you need to have an idea or a character or a scenario that is familiar to your brand. So, for example, I think you have Specsavers, don't you, in Australia. They have this line, should have gone to Specsavers. And it's a joke that's been running for, I think, 22 years. And the whole idea is, you know, you can see a poster where they put the poster upside down, and then there's the strap line, should have gone to Specsavers. So it very simply, they're able to communicate, they own an idea. So, and the power of owning an idea or having a brand character like the M&M's characters or something, basically means that people recognize who you are much more quickly.
It's a shortcut, right?
Absolutely.
It's a great segue, John, into the work that Tourism Australia and Susan Coggle's team did for their global campaign. Now, I hope she's not listening to this one right now, but she did say to me and her fine colleague, Mr. Mark Ritson, that Tourism Australia's global campaign, Say G'day, scored very, very well. I think 4 or 5 star in your System 1 benchmarking. Shall we just have a quiet question here and say, was that true?
100%, mate. I'm a massive Susan fan. And what I love about Susan is she is a real student of the data, the science, and she has an appetite to really understand why things work. And I mean, the thing that amused me about the campaign is it didn't go down that well in Australia, did it? Because it got a bit of a mixed reaction, didn't it? About it's a bit stereotypical.
Early on, the classic cliched, why are we doing more kangaroos to the globe? Those that don't know your stuff, right? So hence 100%. Why there was a bit of that. But it was the opposite.
And mate, it was the opposite. And what I love about it is, like, the first lesson of marketing is you are not the customer. And the first thing you have to do is go out and meet your customer, understand them, and realize that you can't decide for your customer. You have to see what they do. Now, as I said, Susan's a brilliant student of the data and the science and understanding how things work. And she commissioned us at System One to test that campaign, I think, in about 15 markets. And in the vast majority, it scored a 5-star, which would put it in the top 1% of our database. And in the UK
of all campaigns
across the database, across the world, and in the UK, she was in the top 10 ads of last year on our database. So incredible performance. And I was talking about the features of advertising that makes it work. And she delivered every single one of those, whether it's the music, it's the characters, it's the fluent devices, it's the emotion, it's the familiar, you know, Sydney Harbour Bridge, all those things, Sydney Opera House rather, all those things are things that made that campaign work incredibly well. And it was robustly tested many, many times.
So Tourism Australia did well, John, here and globally. What are some of those other brands at a global level that are doing what Tourism Australia has done? And have you got any other data on Australia and how other brands are performing here?
Well, there's a slight delicious irony with the example I'm going to share with you, because if you go back a few years ago, Jeff Bezos of Amazon had this quote that advertising is the tax you pay for an inferior product. Now, fast forward to today.
Grandly ironic, right?
Grandly ironic. Amazon is now the world's biggest advertiser, but more than that, they're also one of the world's best advertisers. So not only have they embraced the medium of advertising, they have also nailed the message in a way that very few on the planet have done. In fact, actually, I released a podcast episode last week with Jo Shoesmith, who is the global chief creative officer for Amazon. She's an Australian, by the way. She's an expat, gone out to, she met an American, moved out there. She now runs creative globally for Amazon. And what's so impressive about Amazon is they have topped our charts for Christmas. They've topped our charts for holidays, for Super Bowl, for ad of the year. Now, what they are masters at, they're absolute masters at, is they've got a fluent device, as I was talking about earlier. So, you know, when you get your Amazon parcel, you've got the smile, you've got the Amazon Prime smile on it. What they've done is they've built that into all their communications. So immediately, you know, that's an Amazon ad. But more than that, the smiling box and the delivery is the resolution to the idea in every ad. So, you know, for example, the Christmas ad in the UK was these three grands, that, you know, three grandmothers, they're sat there on a bench and it's snowing, and one of them has an idea that they should order a sledge. So she goes on Amazon, the sledge arrives in each of their kind of, you know, each of their houses, and then they all join up together and they sled down this hill and they're giggling like they're sort of 12 years old. And then what happens is it cuts back to them as kids, the three girls as you know, childhood friends going down the same slope. So what that does, I mean, I'll try to describe it briefly, but what that does is it had a story to it. Amazon was the solution. It was very obviously Amazon. It created wonderful emotion. It represented people and characters very, very well. And it was the joint number one ad of last year on the System One database. But I'd say Amazon, ironically, given that they were famous for not having advertising, are one of the world's best.
I have to say, based on what I've seen in Australia from Amazon, I'm intrigued, because we ain't seen that sort of stuff. It's probably more tactical stuff here. We don't have those big Super Bowl campaigns and Christmas campaigns that I've seen, John. So it's a surprise for me. All good, John, but what's any of this got to do with media, and specifically, I guess, TV broadcasters and video streamers? And what are you going to tell the future TV advertising crowd tomorrow? Why are you there?
Yeah. Well, look, the message is really clear, right? We've got to talk about the medium, but we've got to talk about the message. And particularly when it comes to TV, BVOD, et cetera, TV remains the most powerful channel at our disposal to tell stories, to create emotion and to build brand. And that remains true. And if you look at the work Karen Nelson Field has done, for example, on attention, you'll see that the attention created on, you know, TV and YouTube and BVOD and so on, audio-visual rich environments, is hugely ahead of what you might be able to achieve on digital platforms. But here's the thing, there is something called attention elasticity, because it's not just enough to get the attention, but actually the creative can massively impact on how much attention you get. So we've done some really good experiments looking at basically a difference between a one-star and a five-star ad on the same, you know, on the same kind of channel, and the difference can be up to three times. So basically the creative matters. It also matters, because what we also find from our research is that the quality of attention increases the amount, your ability of the audience to remember who you are afterwards. So in terms of, you know, being remembered, how you use that platform is incredibly important. So what I'm passionate about basically is talking to the audience about the power of the message and the power of the platform as well to convey the message, and the way in which you can get that right. So I think it's really important. I think as well, you know, the TV industry is going through a little bit of a crisis of confidence, because we're seeing switching in behavior. And actually what I'm trying to do is put the evidence for why there is still a very powerful role for them, and why, and give them the data that can help them sell it in as part of media mixes. Because I know CMOs are making tough decisions between, you know, performance and brand, between TV, between digital. There's a lot of money being moved, particularly now, because everyone's under pressure to deliver results in the shorter term. We're getting more short term in our viewing window, and I want to give people the evidence to take a longer term view.
what you just talked about before is creative matters. That sort of argument sounds like it counters the sort of the mighty Ehrenberg Bass Institute and Professor Byron Sharp. How, you know, as a very brave man you are, John Evans, doing this, because he just essentially talks about not so much about creative, it's about building mental availability, et cetera, et cetera. So are you taking on the professor here?
Well, I think the difference is, I mean, what he's done incredibly is given the evidence for, you know, why, well, basically how brands grow. So basically, if you've got more mental availability, physical ability, basically what I'm doing is showing, if that's why brands grow, I'm telling you how they do it. So how do you create mental availability? Now, they've done some brilliant work on distinctive assets, for example. And so again, at System One, we talk about fluent devices. It's kind of our alternative to that. But really, it's like, what are the types of things you can do in an advert that are more likely to make you distinctive, that will increase the chance of being remembered? So it does work with Ehrenberg Bass, but we're giving people the tools for how do you create that mental availability? How do you get remembered? And also what we know is that emotion and memory are connected. So basically, if you think about a good experience you had in your life, or a good book you read, or a good movie, it will probably be because you felt something. And the evidence suggests that basically the more you feel about it, the more likely you are to remember. So basically what we're doing is helping people get those mental availability, you know, create that mental availability, and we're giving you the toolkit to do it. So although it does feel a bit of a juxtaposition sometimes, it's more about the how to achieve that the what that Ehrenberg Bass would explain are the principles of, big brands growing.
We're going to wrap this up really soon, John, but I've got to ask you one big question is that you talk to, as I said at the top, a lot of CMOs globally on your podcast. Who are some of the standouts that you've spoken to, and why do they stand out for you and what they're doing?
Yeah, no, there's been so many actually, and there's a lot of very successful CMOs doing great work. I think some of the episodes that have got particular traction, for example, would be my conversation with Nancy King at Airbnb, the way they pivoted from performance to brand during the pandemic, where they couldn't sell any Airbnbs because obviously the world was shut down, was very powerful. And it was like a perfect experiment that was able to teach them, you know, what worked and what didn't work. And they've really gone into brand since then, which has been amazing. I'd say Colin Fleming at Salesforce has done an incredible job. You know, they've basically shown the power of creating fluent devices like the characters. Again, they're getting the mix between brand marketing, performance marketing right. I mean, Colin is a
big fan. Which is rare, by the way, for a B2B company, and even rarer for a tech company.
100%. And that's what makes Salesforce so interesting, because they've applied the B2C kind of, you know, understanding to B2B. And of course, what you discover is, as people, we all react the same. So, you know, all the principles still apply in B2B, and they've done a brilliant job of that. And I mean, he's a big fan of the 95-5 rule, you know, the Ehrenberg Bass, about most people are not in the market, and therefore they're taking a long-term view. And their business has grown spectacularly and consistently for many, many years. So, you know, I think, you know, the best marketers are able to get this balance, but you've got to deliver the short. I know that. And you've got to deliver, you know, performance and activation and so on. But they're able to get the balance right and build a powerful brand that's sustainable. That means when you have the short-term challenges, your brand is strong enough to survive and strong enough to grow, sort of thing. And I think really that question, long and short, is the one that the best marketers in the world are able to convince their organizations to get right.
In that conversation you had with Nancy at Airbnb, was it a marketing-led decision that she had to convince further up? And how, you know, I haven't heard that podcast and I want to hear it, because it's what we talk about here in Australia, by the way, a lot, as an example.
It's a really good one, actually. And look, if you listen to it, what's interesting is it was part accident, because they, you know, because of lockdown, they had to turn off a lot of their performance channels. And therefore they're able to see what wasn't working. So it sort of forced them into saying, well, what we're going to do now, we've lost 80% of our business overnight. And therefore they focused on brand, and they saw that as we came out of the pandemic, they saw the power of that. So it was a conversation that was accelerated and sort of forced on them, but they were brave. Well, not brave, but they were doing the right thing, right? So not necessarily brave to do the right thing, but therefore they saw brand work very, very well.
What do you make, very quickly, of the Coke decision a couple of weeks ago to move from 40% to 60% of its ad spend globally into digital channels? What do you make of that?
Well, there's 2 points to make on that. My background is entirely soft drink, so I get this. So the first thing is I understand it. And the reason I understand it is that the average age of a soft drink buyer is very, very young. So soft drinks consumption skews towards youth, right? Younger you are, the more likely you are to drink soft drinks. The older you get, it's hot drinks that take over. So that's number one. Number two, there's what's called a cohort effect, which is most of your decisions, the brands you buy, the how open you are to trying new things also is very young. So, beyond the age of 25, you tend to change your mind less about the kind of portfolio brands you might choose. So you've got, they basically made what is a fairly obvious audience decision, which is to win the next generation of drinkers, we need to target young. Where are they consuming media? They're consuming media on digital and they enjoy experiences and we need to be at the experiences that they're having, kind of thing. So the logic of it makes sense. I'm not necessarily sure whether actually that audience want to be marketed in the way that Coca.
We are really going to wrap this one up now, John Evans. Just interested in your lots of conversations you have with CMOs around the world. What are some of their biggest challenges? Is it their credibility within the organization and the executive leadership team, or is it the incredibly broadening and more complex brief that they and remit they have as marketers? What's keeping them up at night?
Yeah, I think it's a number of things. I think firstly, and linking to some of the conversation we've had actually, is how do you make the case for investment in the long term? How do you put a value on the kind of more brand stuff rather than performance stuff? So, basically having credibility in the boardroom, bringing the data, anchoring marketing, showing the return that marketing delivers for the business and for the brand is always a big challenge. And I think what's lovely is we seem to be on this big effectiveness journey as a marketing industry. And so we've got so much more, so much more data. We've got much better kind of, understanding of how marketing works. And basically CMO needs to bring that to the boardroom and particularly the CEO and the CFO sort of thing. So I think that's a really big one. I think the second big one is dealing with complexity, because whether it's kind of technology change, whether it's kind of media fragmentation and mix, whether it's kind of, trends in society and shifts.
Consumers polarizing, value shifting,
polarization,
expectations.
Man,
yeah.
Well, I mean, just ask Bud Light, what happens when consumers polarize, right? And so the job is becoming very complex, and how you make decisions when you've got different data sources, you've got different objectives and that kind of thing. So I think, CMOs are trying to understand, is this something that I need to pay attention to? Is it not? How do I know what works? How do I know what doesn't work? Do I need to have a point of view on Bud Light? That sort of thing. So I think CMOs are trying to find their way, and they're also in a position where they are the role in the C-suite that has to set direction for the business and have a vision and steer the ship. Because basically when things go wrong, it's the CMO's fault. When things go right, it's a team effort. I mean, that's one thing I've learned from my short-lived CMO career. So you have to be one step ahead. And being one step ahead, being informed on the changes and being able to give an evidence-based response to how marketing is going to dramatically impact on the fortunes of the business, I think is the key job of the CMO. And the funny thing is, right, we talk about the four Ps, but quite honestly, the CMO has quite a different set of four Ps, which in my experience is politics, persuasion, people, and signing off the PO. Because at the end of the day, but marketers, senior marketers in organizations, CMO level, they really don't actually do the marketing. It's quite a surprise to people to realize this when you make the step up from, let's say, a head of marketing or a marketing manager into the hot seat as CMO. You are managing those that do the do. You're not managing it yourself. And you then become part of a C-suite or an executive team that are managing the overall business performance. So your conversations will be about strategy, about people, about finances, about budgets, legal things. So they become the conversations. And this is a real wake-up call, actually, for most people when they make the jump to CMO. It's a very different conversation. And it's a very different dynamic that you have in that position versus, the one below.
Way less about advertising, way less about media. It's a completely different conversation, isn't it?
It is, mate. The funny thing is, actually, I remember actually doing the maths on this because, I remember discussing with my kind of creative agencies the amount of time as a CMO myself I would spend on advertising. And I actually looked through my diary and it was about 5%.
Yeah.
So about 5% of my time is actually spent on. Now, for people within my team, it was a much bigger percent. It might be up to 50%, for example. But for me personally, as a CMO, I'm much more likely to be in strategy conversations, in people reviews, in budget setting, in objective setting, in performance management and those kind of things, or in the factory managing supply chain or managing innovation through a system sort of thing. So I think we forget that because advertising and media is the bit that people see and the bit that people often talk about externally, they assume that that's all the CMO is doing. But actually, in my experience, it's a small minority of their time. And therefore, it makes it hard because, you know, you're not spending all of your time thinking about the creative, all of the time thinking about your media placements, you know. And therefore, it's important that, you know, you have the right data at the right time.
And now they've got other things on their minds as well, like customer experience, technology systems to facilitate that. There's a whole bunch of stuff. So we talk, you know, I think everyone's talking about just how complex the remit is. So listen, I'm going to let you go because we will hear more tomorrow and look forward to hearing that one and surprising with some pearlers. Thanks for joining on the mics, John. And gee, I've had the global guru on. Get your autographs tomorrow. Thank you.
Mate, looking forward to it. Take care.
This MI3 audio edition was presented by Paul McIntyre, that's moi, producer Nick Slater, music by Matt Dwyer. For more episodes, go to listener.com or download the Listener app and search MI3 audio edition to listen for free. Listener.